This episode is brought to you by Intuit, the technology platform that brings financial confidence with products like TurboTax, Credit Karma, QuickBooks, and MailChimp. You might have learned the recorder in school, but probably not how to navigate the financial world. Luckily, Intuit's on a mission to help with the free Intuit for Education program. It provides students with the lessons to learn essential skills, like how to build credit, file taxes, and budget. Check out their free resources at intuit.com/education.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
Hi, everybody. I'm Mark Lorenz, longtime voice of championship sports and world-class championship wrestling. From Dallas, Fort Worth, the Great Sportatorium, Will Rogers Coliseum, Reunion Arena, Texas Stadium, and other great sites. Great to be with you. Great to be a part of this production. We want to share our story with you and hear your stories and your questions. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you again very soon.
All right, folks, you heard it from the man himself. Mark Lorenz is today's guest on Territory Marks. He kicks off season two with our new semi-regular monthly interview series. Mark Lorenz is the legendary announcer. He's the legendary commentator, interviewer for world-class championship wrestling. Oftentimes, Bill Mercer, who rightfully so, is acknowledged as the great one from world-class, but Mark Lorenz is as well, and today you're going to hear his story from us to you.
And the wonderful thing is that we weren't bringing Mark Lorenz here to talk about other people. We brought him here to learn about him. And oh my goodness, I could have just stayed listening to him for days and days and days. I mean, just smoothest voice. It's like the sweetest syrup. Just the friendliest person, and he had those boyish looks, so you knew you were watching wholesome programming. And I am just, thank you for setting that up, and I'm just so blessed that we were able to interact and listen to him and just share our love for the territories and enhance that love for the territories, because Mark Lorenz is as authentic and trusting and pure as they come, and we're just extremely grateful to bring this to you.
Yeah, we absolutely are. You're going to hear a lot of great stories from Mark, and if you want to watch the video version, go to our YouTube channel, the $2 Late Fee YouTube channel, and while you're at it, hit the subscribe button, get our subscription numbers up, and subscribe to $2 Late Fee and Territory Marks, because we're one in the same.
Pick up a shirt, yeah.
Yeah, go to $2LateFee.com, go to TerritoryMarks.com for more information on how you can support the show and be a part of the territories. And until then, enjoy Mark Lorenz.
That's right, from Territory Marks.
World class, Jim Crockett Promotions, big time wrestling, Mid-South. $2 Late Fee presents Territory Marks with Paul London and Zach Schaefer, the show that celebrates matches from the glory days of professional wrestling, from one man who lives it and another man who loves it.
Mr. Mark Lorenz, thank you so much for being our first in-studio, in-person guest on Territory Marks.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, this is really pretty surreal for me. Especially,
it sure is.
Yeah.
It's our first interview, like, actually kind of in-person, too.
Yeah.
Normally we're Zoom and, you know,
that's right.
First time face-to-face.
That's right.
A couple
that's
of silver
right.
spoons.
That's right. You're more handsome in person. You both are.
Listen, the good looks, charm, and sex appeal around this table is going to be world-changing.
I'm telling you, we are going to blow the roof off the ratings for this sucker. Paul obviously has a different background with wrestling than I do. I grew up just as a simple fan and loving what I watched on television, going to the live shows, and grew up in the Bay Area, California, for most of my life, even though when I started out, I was in Michigan and my mom's PE teacher was George the Animal Steel. So that's a whole other story. So he'd wrestle by night and coach by day. But I come out to California and I've got this basic cable feed being able to watch world-class championship wrestling. And I feel like I grew up with your voice, your face, for decades. And I mean, it's sincerely, it's a pleasure to have you on our show.
Face hadn't changed a bit, has it?
It really hasn't. It's that Texas sun, I guess, it's just doing a number on you.
No, it's that Texas lying.
So maybe you got out of the business at just the right time, I guess, right?
Well, I won't talk about Texas politics, but hey, you know, I do miss the
sunshine. It's a lot like wrestling.
It is a lot.
It really is. It really is.
Except those people are really serious about it.
They are. They're not kayfabing it up. And well, they are kayfabing it, right?
They're super kayfabing.
They're super kayfabing.
Yeah. They kayfabe the poor people of Texas. And
that's true.
Yeah, we won't go to it. That's not this show.
Let's get to some wrestling because we want to talk to you. I want to roll it all the way back, if you don't mind, for our listeners. Because a lot of our listeners are very astute wrestling fans, but we have a lot of listeners that are new to this sport, new to the idea of what wrestling was in the 80s. They only know what they see now on television. So if you wouldn't mind taking us back to the inception of your career in world class, how did that all come to be?
Well, it was either providential or a real accident or some of both. But I was an unmotivated undergraduate student at TCU. I had known since high school that I felt leanings toward the ordained ministry.
Okay.
But I just didn't want to pursue that, the academic track, at that point in life. I thought maybe when I get older. So my dad finally raised Cain because he was paying the bills and I was moving slow and I declared radio, TV, film and did the things that a young broadcaster would do and did the college, university's radio station stuff.
Okay.
And did some of their baseball games and, you know, fun stuff like that. And got a job with the Texas State Radio Network, which was, in those days, a network that provided sports and news services to small stations that couldn't afford a big staff all over the big state of Texas.
Right.
And so I would do weekend sports for them, and the feed would go out to all those stations. And got hired to do TCU football and basketball for their public address at the stadium and in the arena. Was having great fun. But all of that had slowed my undergraduate career down, and I was cramming a four-year program into 4.5 years.
Wow.
And so it is the summer that I should have graduated, but I'm going to go back in the fall to finish up because I didn't declare too fast. And I got a phone call from a guy named Steve Harms, who was the number two sports guy for the NBC television affiliate in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Okay.
Transplant from Michigan, big hockey fan. He attended the minor league hockey games that I announced.
Oh, okay, great.
And he was very complimentary, very friendly. We'd become, you know, acquainted with each other. And he said, Mark, there's getting ready to be a PA job open in the area. Are you interested? And I thought, yeah, Rangers, Dallas Mavericks, Dallas Cowboys, sure.
Sure,
yeah.
Why not?
What was the name of the hockey team? Sorry, before I think.
Fort Worth Texans.
The Fort Worth Texans, yep. Okay.
The Central Hockey League, they were a farm team for the New York Islanders.
Cool.
And then that arrangement changed, and they became the farm team for the then Colorado Rockies, who then moved to New Jersey and became New Jersey Devils. But that was a lot of fun. Hockey was great fun. It was right in the penalty box, you know, chairs, tore the convention center scoreboard console up, nearly broke the promotion.
This is funny because you don't think of the hockey in Texas. You know what I mean? We had the Ice Bats in Austin.
Oh,
do
you?
That was our minor league team, the Ice Bats.
The minor league hockey team?
Minor league hockey
team. Okay, because my cousin Luke is a big hockey player, and so is his dad Tom. So they and they're in Texas. They love hockey.
That's so funny.
Hockey's in their blood.
So you just assumed this PA job was for what you would think of as a major league sport.
Yeah.
Right.
What's it going
to
be?
Now, unbeknownst to me, and I didn't know this till years later, Steve Harms knew Fritz von Erich and had done some pilot work for what was going to wind up being the syndicated show, which was World Class Championship Wrestling that Bill Mercer hosted, which was still, you know, a couple of years away. I didn't know any of that. Okay. I just thanked Steve for the tip. Well, he said, Fritz Von Erich is going to call you. And I thought, oh, no, wait a minute, not wrestling.
And you were familiar, obviously, with Fritz at that point.
I knew the name, and I had seen the wrestling show on Saturday night that Bill Mercer was hosting.
Yeah.
And Bill was a great name in our area. Bill covered the assassination of President John Kennedy in 1963.
Right.
Was right in the middle of all of it.
Yeah.
And went on and did a lot of things.
Had you met him before? Were you familiar with
him? I had never met him. We just respected him because he had done the Dallas Cowboys. And they were back at the Cotton Bowl. And did the Dallas-Fort Worth Spurs, which was the minor league baseball team that was the first ever joint Dallas-Fort Worth venture. Okay. Dallas and Fort Worth had each had their own minor league teams, just like hockey did. Those fans went crazy when Fort Worth and Dallas played. And those Canadian hockey players were wondering, you know, what is this all about?
Right.
But they'd sell out, and, you know, even they got into it. Bob Lemieux, who was a coach in Dallas, no, Bob was in Fort Worth, and Bobby Crum was a coach in Dallas.
Okay.
They had some blazers made up where the sleeves were perforated. And they coaches would get into it, and they'd lean over and rip the sleeve off that jacket, and that, of course, would get the crowd ripped.
Amazing.
I'm surprised wrestling hasn't adopted that.
Why not?
Yeah, that's smart. A good word.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, he said, Fritz Von Erich's going to call you. And I knew Bill Mercer was doing it. Bill, as I was saying, was doing the Dallas-Fort Worth Spurs minor league when the Senators moved from Washington to DFW, to Arlington in 71.
Wow. Okay. Wow.
And he got grandfathered in to be their announcer. And so all of a sudden, Bill is doing Major League Baseball. The city of Arlington owned the team, and they owned the broadcast rights, and they weren't paying a Major League salary because they couldn't, because they're off a tax base and a team that was losing money when it first came there.
Right.
And Bill got frustrated with the salary, and they said, just be patient, Bill, it will come. Mm. But Bill quit and got a job in Chicago with the White Sox. Harry Carey, who most fans will remember with the Cubs, who had gotten fired in St. Louis for having the alleged affair with one of the Bush daughters, and incidentally, never admitted to it and never denied it.
Right.
He said, how can I deny a rumor like that? My God, it was so flattering. There I was in my 40s, and this gorgeous heiress, I can't deny that. He was just one of those characters, and he connected with Bill Veeck, who should have owned a wrestling promotion, but owned the White Sox and was the shadow of the Cubs and was doing a lot of gimmicky stuff. And Harry learned to sing Take Me Out the Ball Game in the seventh inning and took his shirt off and broadcast from the bleachers.
Right.
And a disco demolition night and all that crazy stuff up there. Well, Bill was the number two guy.
Okay.
And Bill somehow got it in his mind that Harry's vulgarity was going to get him fired, and Bill would be grandfathered in. Well, he grossly underestimated the relationship that Bill Veeck and Harry Carey had. And one night they were, I think, in Boston after the game at Fenway Park, and all the writers and the players were in the bar after the game. And in those days, a paid telephone call was a dime, 10 cents.
Right.
And Harry Carey put a dime on his thumb and hollered across the room, hey, Mercer! Captured all the players, all the writers. Next time I'm going to get fired, pal, would you at least give me a phone call? And flip the dime.
Wow. Oh, my gosh.
And in a matter of days,
oh my goodness,
the Chicago papers announced that Bill Mercer had been given the axe.
No.
Wow.
No.
So back to Texas he came.
Yeah.
And he went to work for the University of North Texas, which then was North Texas State. And he had connected with Fritz because Bill had done some wrestling when he was a young guy in Oklahoma. And Fritz thought with Bill's great resume, the Rangers, the Cowboys, Major League Baseball, he would add credibility to the wrestling show. And he hired Bill. Well, I knew that story, and I knew Bill was the host of the only show they had then, which was every Saturday night on Channel 11. They recorded it on Monday. The live event was Monday night at Will Rogers. And so when Fritz called me, I already had my gracious decline ready.
Right.
Because I didn't know anything about wrestling. I had no interest in it. Just, you know, wasn't my thing.
Yeah.
And Fritz gets on the phone and has this imposing presence, even just in voice, and explains that he wasn't hiring me long term. He needed a 3-week fill-in.
Hmm.
Sunday night is when they ran the Sportatorium, and Monday night is when they ran Fort Worth. He wanted me to work a Monday, Sunday for 3 weeks.
Okay.
Paid generously, more than I got doing hockey games. And I thought, hell, for 3 weeks, what have I got to lose? What am I going to do if I don't do it? So I agreed to do it, not, you know, sure what I was getting into. Is this going to be shady? Are they going to pay it all?
Right.
And I showed up at Will Rogers Coliseum on a Monday night, and they had to tell me who the wrestlers were. This is Zach Schaefer. This is Paul London. And then I could, you know, sound good and do the introduction and introduce the referee. But I was that green. They had to teach me everything.
And was Bill Mercer there when you got there? When did you first meet him?
Bill was there.
Okay.
This was in the summer of 1981, and Bill was doing the TV. So we didn't have a lot of interaction, but I was introduced. Bill's a great guy. He's very smart. He's very educated. And he's a lot of fun. But I had just met him. He was very courteous, very gracious. And in those days, the state regulated wrestling like it was boxing. They had a doctor present. They had a state timekeeper there. He had to get a license.
Oh, wow.
So we were all there at the ringside table. And Bill did the TV. And he would go over and do the intro and come over then and sit down and do the play-by-play. He was by himself. Then go over and do the interviews and back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And Channel 11 did this as a low-budget deal that Fritz actually paid for. He was buying the time.
Okay.
And a lot of the territorial promoters bought their own time.
Yeah.
And there was no post-production. Mistakes stayed mistakes. It was just like doing it live.
Yeah.
And they did it in such a way where they got just into the main event. And they timed it then when they were out of time, wish you were with us, you know, oh, it's going to be so long, everybody, to bait the crowd, you know, to want to be there in person.
Right.
Very low production. Two cameras, one on the edge of the balcony and one down on the interview set, and they just back and forth is all they did. Well, I worked those 3 nights, and since it was Monday, Sunday, my last night was Sunday night in Dallas. They had paid in cash every night. They were gracious. They were complimentary. They were friendly. They were fun. And so after the 3 weeks, I'm saying, hey, thank you all.
Yeah.
Now, I've never been around Fritz yet.
Okay. In those 3 weeks you had
He wasn't there.
He may have been around.
In the office up above. Somewhere.
But, you know, I was just showing up at the building, and he was beginning to slow down a little by then in terms of his ring presence.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thanked him and said, if you need anybody again, please give me a call. Oh, we sure will. You know, don't call us. We'll call you.
Right.
Sort of thing.
And who are you mostly dealing with at this point then?
Just whoever was around.
Okay.
David Manning, who'd been a referee and then on the promotion, Bronco Lubitsch, Ed Watt, who kind of was the office manager at the Sportatorium.
Okay.
The Fort Worth office was run by Elizabeth Moore, who used to have the promotion themselves back in the days before Fritz did his power play and got it.
Okay.
And Fritz kept them on kind of as a front, kind of as the local ticket broker.
Okay.
And they got a piece of the action, and they had a little office there at Will Rogers.
Got it.
Well, it's now Monday, the next night, and I've gone to my parents' house in Fort Worth to have dinner. And my mother is fixing a meal for me, my sister, my dad, and herself. And the wall landline phone rings. And it's Kathleen D. White, who is Fritz Von Erich's secretary upstairs at the Sportatorium, saying, we are looking for Mark Lowrance, who has helped with Southwest Sports, which is what the name of the promotion was then,
okay,
for the last 3 weeks. And my mother says, well, that's my son, and he happens to be here right now. Well, there's been a terrible mistake. We need him at the building tonight.
Oh.
So okay, this was about 6 o'clock. The show started at 8. My mom got dinner on the table. I ate quickly, ran home. I live close to the building.
Okay.
Put on a coat and tie and got there about 7:45.
Wow.
And nothing was ever said about what the mistake was or where was the guy that I was replacing, because he was a singer. His name has been verified in some other stuff, documentary stuff that I've seen. He mm-hmm. had gone to Europe to sing for 3 weeks and was supposed to be back. Did he not come back, or had Fritz not been satisfied with him? Or was the three-week deal a gig, so if I turned out to be a clown or somebody wasn't very good, Fritz had an easy out?
Right.
I'll never know.
Right.
But the ring announcing job became mine. Now, there's no TV involved.
Okay.
The TV's on Monday that Bill does, and it's a house show that I do the PA, so to speak, and then I do the public address ring announcer in Dallas on Sunday nights. And that's how it started.
Wow.
Wow. Were you familiar with the Sportatorium beforehand? Like, did they own that? I mean, did they own that building? Or Will? Did you say Will Rogers?
Will Rogers Coliseum was the big city-owned complex for the rodeo, the circus. They have a big auditorium.
Okay,
it's an old historic works project administration building with a tower and the Coliseum, the auditorium next to each other.
Is it still there?
Still there. Still cool. Very active.
Wow.
And they just paid rent to use it every Monday night. The hockey team played there, too.
Okay.
The Sportatorium was owned by a man named Alford, who was an older, very successful businessman in Dallas, owned a lot of refrigerated warehouses mm-hmm. and other buildings. And he leased the Sportatorium to Fritz.
Okay.
And as the lessee, Fritz got all the concession. So, you know, when they had a big house on a Sunday night...
Yeah.
And had a good gate plus the concession, it was a good deal for Fritz.
Wow.
So Monday rolls around, you race over there, do your job, and that's where you stay for better part of, 10 years or so, maybe?
Yeah, that's how it started out.
It's crazy.
That's
with
wild.
Bill's career at the college, he was also doing football and basketball for North Texas.
Yeah.
So he was missing a lot, especially during basketball season.
Okay.
And they were bringing in a guy from the same NBC affiliate. Nice man. Really a classy guy. But he obviously knew about as much about wrestling as I did. And he had no passion. And it was just real slow. And... very deliberate.
Right.
And Schaefer in a black shirt with white and red, you know. And,
come from baseball, or was he a baseball?
Well,
baseball?
No, he never did much play by play. He was a sports anchor.
He was a librarian, is what he was.
It's what it sounded like. And I thought to myself, you know, this is absurd. He's killing the show.
Right.
Yeah.
And on my nerve one night in Fort Worth, I just walked up to Fritz, who by now I had met. He'd been very complimentary, very gracious. And I said, Fritz, Bill's gone a lot. He's got a lot of neat opportunities. And I mentioned the guy by name. I said, he's a great guy, but you need some excitement. Would you be willing to give me a shot at the television?
Wow.
And Fritz, you know, GD, you've been reading my mind, puts his arm around me. Takes me into the Bookers, which was Gary Hart, and Bronco and David were there, and said, we're sending Mark out with Bill tonight to do some color. And it went well, and the next week Bill was out, and the next week there I stood, ready to be the TV host. Still very green.
Yeah.
But that's how it started. And then, unbeknownst to me, they were in negotiations with Mickey Grant out of Channel 39 in Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
For what was going to be the syndicated show.
Right.
Channel 11 was getting ready to go up on the satellite and kind of be like WTBS out of Atlanta, WGN out of Chicago, which meant our show was going to expand there.
Yeah.
But this syndicated deal really had promise. and they were in the process of moving the Sunday night show at the Sportatorium to Friday nights.
Okay.
And then they would tape 2-hour-long syndicated tapes on a Friday night and then have a house show the next week.
Okay.
Just live audience. Yeah. And Bill was going to be grandfathered in to do the syndicated show because he was a senior guy.
Right.
And then they gave me Channel 11. And Channel 11 not only went up on the satellite, but when I took over, they expanded from 60 minutes to 90 minutes. And then 90 minutes to 2 hours. Had the highest rating of any program Channel 11 had, had the Rangers and the Mavericks, and our ratings were higher.
Bigger than that.
Yeah.
They said, well, it's a different demographic, you know, and we can't get quite the dollar. But it was going great. And that's how it emerged into what you would remember. And then when Bill would be out from the syndicated show, I would step in for him. Otherwise, I was the ring announcer on those world-class shows.
Wow.
When did it go from did it ever just become strictly the Sportatorium? That's kind of what it became, right? Did they kind of go away from the Coliseum after a while, or did they keep it kind of in the back pocket for big shows? Or
no, Will Rogers was the site for the show every Monday night, which remained the Channel 11 tape. Because
okay.
The syndicated show in Dallas did not change Channel 11 outside it was growing. They still tape that. But the production became so innovative with the world-class show when it started in 82 or whatever year it was.
Yeah.
With the instant replay, the slow motion, the cameras on the apron, the mics on the cameras.
Right.
That Channel 11 on their own said, we got to up our game because the production is upstaging us. And so they added a third camera on the apron and we up, you know, our show a little bit. And they could do a little bit of post-production.
Okay.
Especially when there was a major mistake or if we had a death, like Gino Hernandez or somebody, we could go back and add that to the show. But Channel 11 stayed the Will Rogers tape until about the time the Von Erichs got out of it.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
By the time that Jerry Jarrett bought it, the houses were so low in Fort Worth and the ratings had dropped, they started sending Channel 11 footage from the Sportatorium.
Okay.
But that was in 88 or so.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to think of footage in my head, and it's always in my mind. I always just pick, I see the Sportatorium.
Yeah.
And so I try to think of what it would look like. And I'm sure I've seen matches there. I just assumed probably it was the Sportatorium, but
it probably was because all of the world-class championship wrestling tapes were done at the Sportatorium in Dallas.
Okay.
So Fort Worth show was called Championship Sports on Channel 11.
Okay.
And it was always done from Will Rogers.
I see. Wow.
Wow. So how did you deal with your nerves at that time? Were you nervous going into this? Like once you had those 3 weeks to kind of, you were in the trenches.
And how accepting were the wrestlers in terms of like, you know, they're thinking, oh, here's this. You know, were they thinking that you were just like a Mark, which you weren't even a Mark because you weren't
I'm
into
Mark,
wrestling?
M-A-R-C.
Well, Mark by name.
You're Mark by name. But, you know, they're probably thinking, oh, who's this Mark, you know, in the locker room with us, you know? And you weren't even a Mark in terms of wrestling because you were like, I don't even know who any of you are, you know? That must have rubbed some of them kind of wrong.
It was kayfabe when I was in the room for about the first 90 days.
Wow.
And then, you know, it becomes obvious when you're in there.
Yeah.
And you're sitting down and going over things with the bookers. You know, kayfabe, not going to fly.
Right.
And so they say, well, we'll smarten him up as if, though, you know, I hadn't already been. But two things helped me. Number one, Fritz was so complimentary of my work from the get-go. The guys heard that. And, you know, Fritz is the godfather and the owner and the boss. So if Mark's going to be liked, then we need to like him too.
Right.
Plus, Fritz had this interesting ethic. Monday Night Football was big in those years. Howard Cosell, Don Meredith, Frank Gifford, and they had a great chemistry.
Mm.
And they wore those jackets, you know, with the ABC logo on them. And Fritz always told the boys, we want Bill Mercer and Mark Lowrance to be just as respected by our audience as those guys on Monday Night Football.
Wow.
So you respect them. Now, you can yell and holler at each other. You can yell and holler at them, but don't ever touch them. They're never part of the show. They are to be seen as objective journalistic reporters. And so the favor and that ethic helped us to be kind of aloof, so to speak, as a part of the production, so that the fans would respect us. And it worked well.
Yeah.
Did they maintain that?
Yes, they did.
Okay, good.
There was an exception where I was asked to be the special referee in a mud match between Sunshine and I think the other valet was Raven. I'm not sure.
Okay.
And the gimmick was I was going to get drug into the mud at the end, which was fine. It was great fun.
Right.
I still have my apron. I still wear it when I grill out.
That's amazing.
Sunshine and Raven.
Oh, really?
Mud match.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And then there was a night where they grabbed me and choked me in the late 80s. Mark, you've got to sell this. You've got to look scared.
Sure.
And so I did, and it accomplished whatever they wanted to do.
I'm sure it did.
Then there was one accidental night. Abdullah the Butcher, the madman his steel spike. Either I was where he was going to be or he was where I was, and neither one of us knew it. And one of us had to flinch. And it couldn't be him because I wanted him to stay in character as the heel. So I let him attack me, and he had to. It was just the way it worked. We were out on the floor.
Yeah.
And I don't know what he did to me, but I sold it to the best of my ability, hit the ground, went down, had to be helped out, gasping, crowd all, you know, and we called him Abby behind the scenes. He's waiting for me at the door that opened up for the heels. They pulled a deal and opened it and closed it back. And he had this big grin on his face, and he said, "Baby, you didn't feel a thing, did you?" I said, "Abby, I didn't feel a thing. I told you I know how to do this. I know how to work." And I really didn't. But
amazing. Well, for those that are unfamiliar with Abdullah the Butcher, he's a very imposing person, on camera at least. And his forehead looks like it's just been mashed up with razor blades
hamburger beef.
Yeah. And so I can only imagine, no matter how sweet he is outside after that, that must have been quite an experience for you.
I got to see Abby. It'll be 3 years ago this summer at the Gathering in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Okay.
He was on a walker, but he still carried his dinner fork. And nice. There's a picture in my phone of me posing next to him with that fork up on my brow. So,
I'm bummed I never went to his restaurant.
Oh, yeah, the barbecue place. So you love barbecue. So
chicken and waffles and barbecue and Chinese food, I think.
Right, right.
I think it was all these things in one somehow.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. I mean, I also want to talk to you about most wrestling fans nowadays are so used to a multi-person team in the booth, right? Calling the matches.
Right.
But we talk about this on the show, having that single voice can be really challenging and it doesn't always work. But you and Bill, but specifically you, because you're on our show and we're talking to you, Mark, had such a way of carrying the match and describing and having that energy of not just calling it, but also feeling that passion, that excitement at the same time. How did you kind of come into your own as a commentator in that way, just finding your own voice?
Well, you know, I got to give a lot of credit to the mystery for that.
Okay.
To the creator for that, because that was setting me up for a rapport that I was going to need, you know, when I finished and went on into parish ministry.
Right. But
I remember we were about 8 weeks into me being the regular guy on Channel 11 because Bill had been moved over to the syndicated show. And Fritz took me aside in the locker room in Fort Worth one night and again put his arm around me and he said, Mark, you're sounding great out there, son. But before my chest could bulge, he said, but you look like shit. You've got to stand in front of the mirror at home and let your face express what your voice is expressing.
you've got to have some facial animation.
Interesting.
And he was dead right.
Right.
Because I was so focused on getting it right, and I have ADD anyway, I've struggled with that all my life, that I was almost stone-faced. And he said, we don't want the crowd to think you're arrogant. And so I took that to heart and began on the interviews and the promos where people could see me to do the facial expressions. And then to realize that I was the play-by-play guy, as well as the promoter, as well as the color guy, and the damage control psychologist.
Right.
And so I used to try to blend all that in, and I began to talk to the audience in an almost personal, hokey-like way. And some of that goes back to old Harry Carey that we talked about with Bill Mercer, because he was the master at that.
Yeah, he really was.
And he came across as the friend that everybody knows in the town pub.
Mm-hmm.
And he would read names, you know, the so-and-sos are here from Shenoa, Illinois. And the producers of WGN didn't like that.
Okay.
And they would shovel names to him, fictitious names, and Harry would never catch on. The Blunder Muffins are here tonight from Joe's Bar and Grill in Streeter, Illinois, you know. But I picked up just enough of that to help the audience feel comfortable with me.
Yes.
To trust me. And that's how all that worked. And it was fun to be the one guy. And when they did send a color guy out, it was an adjustment.
Right.
And in the later years, especially when Jarrett took over and we had regular color people, Frank Dusick or whomever it might be.
Yeah.
It was very, very different. And while the color person brings some perspective, you don't get to carry the storyline as well, because you can't talk about what happened last week and 2 weeks ago.
Right.
And compare with where this is going. So there are advantages to, you know, both approaches.
I see you standing in front of your mirror as a young person in your 20s and, you know, with your jacket on, your whole outfit, with your facial expressions. Because as an actor, we do the same thing. You know, it's I remember when I first started taking voice acting lessons, and my coach was like, you know, we're doing the whole expressions, full body movement, everything. Just make sure you stay in front of the mic, you know, and you don't think about that when you just hear the voice. You don't think about what they're doing. It's all different now. But way back then, yeah, I mean, talk about, you have a whole experience. And what a great lesson that Fritz gave you. What a gift he gave you in that recommendation. You know, it's that clearly helped you. You know, we watched a match with it was Kerry Von Erich versus Sid Vicious from like 1988. And you were with Frank Dusick on commentary. And it did have a different vibe to it. Frank very much had that, I don't want to, WWF type voice, you know, the Jesse Ventura thing.
Yeah,
but
he
you
was
maintained
wild.
Your composure. And that's that glue that keeps you invested into the match. It's not necessarily the little quips of the one liners or whatnot.
Right.
I think the Skandor Akbar was coming in and interfering with you too at the time.
Yeah. Ak was such a great guy. I had a hard time keeping a straight face with him.
Really?
Yeah, he's
And
funny.
When his folding chair would collapse and other accidents would happen, we would just bury our head. But it's interesting. I learned back in that one-man show era that when you're doing an interview and the heels are going on, you don't have to respond to them verbally. What you say with your eyes or with your facial expression, you can feign mistrust or confusion, and the audience will pick up on that without ever coming out of the journalistic objectivity that Fritz wanted. And all of that stuff helped. So,
were there any wrestlers in particular that also might have helped in that regard in terms of, you know, just any kind of advice from their standpoint, you know? Because, I mean, when I watch wrestling now, it really irritates me when I see wrestlers grab the microphone out of, you know, the hand of who's interviewing them, and then they just kind of disappear.
Yeah.
You know, and that's just, to me, that it just looks terrible, and it's disrespectful. But I think a lot of wrestlers, especially today, aren't brought up with a sense of pride for the craft and the history. And a lot of that etiquette goes away. So I'm curious if there were wrestlers that also helped to smarten you up, in addition to, you know, everyone who was behind the scenes, but and in front of the camera in your position, but wrestlers with just that knowledge and that were just generous, you know?
The boys had very little to say about any of it.
Wow.
They would complain about me a little bit and about Bill a lot as being too sophisticated at times.
Really?
Because Bill grew the beard because he was teaching at the university, and we would each say things that would put an intellectual twist, just drop in here and there.
Right.
But what the guys didn't realize is that was enabling us to reach a segment of culture that normally wouldn't watch wrestling.
Absolutely.
But they liked the psychology and whatever they would describe it. I just met with a guy in January of this year that gave me a set of railroad books because he was in a publishing company in Dallas in the 80s, and he wrote me a letter about his delight in watching me on Channel 11. It was very complimentary. And he talked about some of the things we're talking about and verbalized it better than I can. And I don't know what the deal was. I never got back with him, never thanked him until this year.
Okay.
And I found him now way up in years and took the books and met him for lunch and showed him the letter and thanked him after all these years for the nice letter. But he was an example of a segment of audience that would not watch wrestling if it were not for Fritz's ethic and the ability we had to give some psychological perspective to what is going on and just drop it in. Don't belabor it. Don't overdo it.
Yeah.
Because you plant a seed and intelligent people will pick it up and run with it.
Yeah.
And that worked for us.
Yeah.
And so I remember trying to explain that to the boys, and some of them would catch on and some of them wouldn't.
Sure.
But whenever they wanted to get upset, they'd get upset, for example, if I was telling another story or promoting another card or making another reference and not actually calling what was in the ring. They wanted me to describe everything they were doing. But in my world, I had to take care of the business and pace myself into the match as it got to critical moments.
Right.
And some of the younger guys, some of the more egotistical guys couldn't accept that.
Sure.
They wanted the focus on them. And I would just listen to them and love them and go on about my business.
Sure.
Well, I think that's kind of what we do on our show. We there's a lot to rail on or criticize, but we try to focus on that positivity, which is what pushes you forward ultimately in life. And I'm curious, can you name anybody that stands out to you that was supportive of you in that way? Any of the boys?
Well, Ric Flair, and I'm sure he did this with everybody. He was the world champion then, as you know, had followed Harley Race. And he presented himself so well on interviews and projected his personality so well. He would always come to Fort Worth or Dallas, get 14% of the gross whenever he appeared in those days. And he would start the interview by saying, "Mark Lawrence, you're without a doubt one of the finest young wrestling announcers we're blessed to have in all," you know, things like that, just classy
That's cool.
stuff.
Yeah.
And he would back that up privately as well, which was very affirming and very nice. And the Akbars, the Armand Hussein, some of the good heels that had a better personality anyway would also be complimentary, and they would want to have a friendship. They'd want to have a relationship.
Sure. That's
great. And that was great. I loved Hussein. He was so much fun. He wasn't one of the big names, and he wasn't as precise in the ring as a great worker would be, but he was so much fun, and he was so good with the crowd as a heel. And he was just hilarious. He and I became great buddies.
That's fantastic. Nice. You know, on our show, we cover one match from the territories. It makes me wonder, is there one or two matches that stand out in your opinion that you are proud of as far as your commentating is concerned? Not necessarily the match quality, but how you approached it, you know, verbally.
Yeah, there were some. All of it was fun. All of it was important because you're always building towards something greater.
Right.
One night I'll never forget that I didn't have anything to do with in terms of television. I was just the ring announcer. Was the slamming of the cage door with the Freebirds and the Von Erichs when the Birds went heel at Reunion Arena, Dallas. I thought that was brilliantly done. Kerry winning the world title in 84, that was at Texas Stadium, and that was a syndicated tape. That wasn't my show. But Bill was going to be out, which he was regularly. And he had told Fritz 6 or 8 weeks in advance that May, the whatever it was date, he had to be somewhere. And it really made Fritz mad because this was the pinnacle of the whole promotion.
Yeah,
and he said, well, you know, I won't use the language. That's fine. We'll just use Mark Lawrence. Yeah. And so that became, you know, my day. And so I got to call Kerry winning the world title.
We covered that match on the show.
Yeah.
That was your pick, actually.
Yeah, that's great.
Here's Flair from the ropes. Wants to toss Kerry across. Kerry's got it. Here's the Nelson pin. Two. Three. The dream comes true. Yes.
The new heavyweight world heavyweight champion, Kerry Von Erich.
The wrestlers pouring out of the locker room. 50,000 fans standing and roaring. Flair doesn't know what happened to him. Has come true. Let's watch this celebration.
And, you know, in that environment with 35, 38,000 people there, it was hard not to get pumped. Yeah. And you'd had the emotion of David's death.
Right.
And, you know, it had a little bit of a church quality to it.
I was going to say it maybe helped prepare you for the ministry with that gospel of the crowd.
Sure.
All in support of what was going on in that ring, you know, and that family.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the church. You can imagine the Sportatorium. You felt the electricity from that in a Texas Stadium.
Yeah.
My church work a lot of times was more... The audience was very different.
Sounds like the church I went to when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I never had the same appeal. I tell people now, I gave my backside for 33 years in the church to love people, preach, build the church, raise the money, build the buildings, and now that I'm done, nobody remembers my name. But 9 years with a wrestling promotion, and I'm going all over the country.
So. Well, I tell you what, you know, and yeah, and God bless you for that, because this is the era we love. It's the era that needs to be reminded. You know, today's audience, today's generation, I sound like an old guy. They forget. We're short attention span theater. You know, it's more so now than it was when we were coining that phrase, short attention span theater, you know, with flipping up things and scrolling things. But I think just in the same way that we never got rid of books when ebooks came out, right? They said, oh, books are dead. No one's going to read books anymore. Sure. They didn't die. Same with records, you know, oh, vinyl's over. We're just going straight to MP3 and iPods. It's making a comeback. It continues. And, you know, it's got a niche audience. I think wrestling is that way too. I think there's going to be those fans that go, no, I want to know where this started. I want to know where these guys came from, where they got their knowledge from.
Well, I think that the level of realism, because everything was approached with the essence of realism, you know,
right, approach it
with realism, that's going to always translate no matter what year you watch it, no matter if it's slower or whatever. Because, of course, the athleticism today is...
It's different.
It's better than it's probably ever been athletically.
Yes.
Of course, technology has improved, supplements have improved, blah, 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 whatever. But there are more injuries than ever, right? There are more injuries than ever. And the work looks more ridiculous than ever and just unbelievable. It just, you know, constant shotgun blasts to the face and they're still alive and they're, you know, and so it's you can't, you don't want to digest that because it's, I can't.
No.
And so when you think of territory wrestling in which the participants themselves kayfabed their own families into believing it was real, you're damn well going to believe what you're seeing,
right?
Because they're presenting it as real as they can. So it's, to me, it's timeless. It's I could watch it forever.
Well, you know? Paul, what you're describing is not only absolutely accurate in my opinion, but those old regional territory promoters understood that, and they had lived it. And Jerry Jarrett, who was very, very smart and very educated, actually developed his own term for what you're describing, and he called it suspension of disbelief.
Hmm.
And it's a fine line,
right,
to suspend the natural inclination to disbelieve this.
Right.
And what's happened in recent years is they've gone too far the other way with the acrobatic talent, the wild stunts. I mean, when we used to have a chair shot, that was pretty rare. Yeah. And when you took a chair shot, we didn't see you for a few weeks.
Right.
And that's what has changed. And it may be an overcompensation for the loss of kayfabe to try to get it back, but it's just too much.
Yeah.
I think kayfabe is a never-ending commitment to the pride of the craft, you know, to the mystique. It's a commitment. I feel that when people think, "Oh, well, kayfabe's dead," I mean, then you're the one basically admitting to me you lack the commitment to follow through with it all the way and fully commit to it, because that's what kayfabe is.
Yeah, hence
it really is.
Kayfabe Academy, which is Paul's Academy, which everybody should go check out, by the way. Go to Instagram and check out KFAVE Academy. Cheap plug for that, by the way.
Yeah, thanks.
As we start to wrap up, we have a couple questions from fans. I wanted to get in just a couple. I want to get his name right. Scott Lawrence asked you a question. He said, "World Class was well produced both in ring and behind the camera. He'd like to know about the impact behind the scenes with the crew, specifically the work of the great Lee Martin and his team at Lee Martin Productions. Can you speak about kind of the impact that they had on the overall product?"
Well, in Fort Worth, we had a director named Jim Lunn, and the improved production there was all run by him. And he took pride in his work. In Dallas, Keith Mitchell was our main producer for the Channel 39 show.
Okay.
And they took great pride in what they did. And the crew had creative input and fun with what they were doing. And they were proud of what they did.
Right.
And as the ratings skyrocketed locally, as the syndicated market skyrocketed and it was being seen all over the world, they really took pride in it. And that was fun, and it was very contagious to be around.
Yeah, I mean,
it got basically, I mean, this is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this is what Jerry and then Vince ended up basically just taking all of that and using it, you know, and a lot of people don't think of where it really was rooted.
No, I mean,
right here,
right.
And, you know, and that's where it started. And so, you know, it's funny because people think like, "Oh, well, Vince was like so innovative with his cameras for the XFL and stuff like that." I'm like, no. I feel like that's still rooted all the way back to the Sportatorium.
Right.
Well, and see, Fritz was really the first who did that, because Fritz was the first guy whose show got seen in other promoters' territories.
Yeah.
Because before, everybody else had their own TV in the territory.
Right.
And so that's when people started pressing Fritz to go big, go national, go run against these people. And Fritz, for whatever the reason, whether it was fear of God's judgment because of David's death and the boy's struggles with drugs, or if it was an admirable old allegiance to all those old promoters that, you know, he had known and worked with and helped build his career, he just wouldn't do it.
Right.
He would send his boys in to help their card and take a percentage of the gate,
right,
but he wouldn't run against them until it finally began to go toward Vince. And we started to have, we flew to Boston for some shows there. Fritz was too cheap to rent the Boston Garden, so we went to the Lynn Municipal Stadium outdoors and still pulled a big house.
I bet you did.
But Fritz wouldn't do that, and that frustration is why so much of the talent then began to give up on world class and take Vince up on his offers.
Yeah.
But going back to what you're saying, Paul, about how all this got built in the territory days.
Yeah.
Fritz may have been doing the first with what we've talked about with the replay and the apron cameras and the sound effects. But think about what Jarrett was doing in Tennessee.
Right.
They did that whole deal with Andy Kaufman.
Right.
And that wound up on David Letterman or somebody.
Yeah. National television.
Yeah.
And there's Kaufman saying,
Coliseum.
Jerry Lawler broke his neck, you know. And so those territory people were doing great work.
Yeah.
And that's what built what became, you know, the WWF, now WWE, and WCW.
Right.
And sometimes I wonder if people didn't forget that.
Well, I want everyone to, you know, go back and watch those old, thank the gods for YouTube, because you can go on there and check out these old episodes, specifically with Mark Lawrence. L.A. WrestleChick, who has a lot of questions, but I'm going to cut it to one. In your opinion, how did Fritz treat the women wrestlers and the international wrestlers in world class, in your opinion?
Fritz was not overly involved in the direct relationships with the talent.
Okay.
They had their production meetings. The bookers carried out the orders. When Fritz would come down and be involved, he generally just had a friendly rapport and would take an interest in them. Glad to meet you. Thank you for being here. You're doing great. But Fritz was never the boss in that role. While he was the boss, he let his bookers and his other people be the boss.
Like David Manning.
Yeah. So Fritz had a good reputation with pretty much everybody that came in, unless they, you know, were upset about their payoff, and that was common for the business.
Right. My mom, Carol McKee, she wanted to know if you could have a song play you out to the ring, what would it be? Did you have ring music? Or if you didn't, what would that song be?
That's a good question. I've never been asked that.
We ask the good questions on our show.
I never had my own song because, you know, the announcer wasn't that big a deal in terms of the production.
Right.
Now, my most embarrassing moment on planet Earth occurred regarding a song and my intro. Our big shows were wrestling Star Wars, where we went to Reunion Arena, Fort Worth Tarrant County Convention Center. In about 87, the promotion was waning. It was struggling. And a lot of the people had left that had been a part of its success.
Okay.
And one of those, I think, but I'm not sure, was David Manning, who had the Star Wars music for the Star Wars shows. Well, I had, in those days, a turntable that had a cassette built into the console of the turntable, which was innovative.
Yeah, you sure was.
And I said, don't worry about it. I've got the Star Wars record. I'll make a cassette tape, which I did and had it ready. Well, we had a Star Wars show that was just going to be at Will Rogers. It was going to pull probably 5,000 people instead of 12, but it was still a good house.
So decent, yep.
And I said, I'll take the cassette tape up to James Patman, who was the union guy that worked for the city of Fort Worth up in the sound booth of the Coliseum, to play the Star Wars theme. Because what they did was they had spotlight operators that they paid for. The lights in the building go out. The Star Wars theme plays triumphantly over the PA, and the spotlights dance. And then they zone in on me, and it's arousing. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and we go from there. Well, I had started seminary.
Okay.
And I was going to have to miss a New Testament class that met at night to call the TCU basketball game. The professor was a big basketball fan. He thought it was neat that I was the announcer.
Oh, yeah.
He said, don't worry about it. Just tape the lecture, and I'll count you present. Well, that night I grabbed a cassette tape, take it out to the seminary classroom, and record the lecture. Unbeknownst to me, a few weeks later, it's time to go to Will Rogers for this Star Wars show, and I take the cassette up to James Patman. And so 5,000-6,000 people coming in, the lights go down, and it's not just the fact that it was an academic, it's what it was about. Because instead of the Star Wars theme, you hear Dr. Bill Baird from Bright Divinity School. For Paul, the Hebrew tradition of circumcision referred to a Jewish rite of purification that had internal perspective as well as an outwardly focused experience as well. And I stood there, and there was no place to hide.
Oh, my God.
No place to run. And the sound guy just kept thinking that song's going to, he just kept turning the volume
no!
up. Circumcision was, and it just went on and on. And I just, it seemed like it went for an hour.
Yeah.
Of course, it went for 3 or 4 minutes. And when I got back to the locker room after the first match, it's screaming and profane. What? And I didn't know what to say. Was God, he screwed that up, you know? So.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing.
I would imagine. I mean, did any of the boys pull some pretty big ribs on you at all? Were there?
No, they didn't seem to catch on. I'm
That's
not sure.
That's a pretty damn big rib.
They could
on himself.
They could hear the exact verbiage of it from where they were. But I got out of that one real easy.
Wow.
But I have never forgotten that moment.
Holy
and
smokes.
That's one story that my church people, when they're, oh, they'd come too for that.
I can just imagine these people coming into the stadium and then they start hearing this talk about, you know.
That is amazing. That is one of those moments that gets parodied in movies, you know. So,
yeah.
And I, you know. We could talk to you another hour on this show, and especially because I'd love to get your thoughts on the Iron Claw film that came out, but we'll save that for another time, I think.
I would love another time if possible, because I still have so many questions, both for me personally, but as a Mark as well, just because, you know, we didn't even really delve into much of the wrestling, but
right.
I mean, this has just been fantastic. Absolutely. I mean, I could just listen to you all day.
Well, let's just make it happen.
Yeah, let's make this a regular thing.
Yeah.
Now, we did have David Manning on earlier in the year. That was via Zoom, and he was gracious to give his time as well. And at one point down the road, maybe we can get the four of us together in a room and have a
I would love to see David. David called me, it's been years ago now, when his mother passed, and asked if I would do her funeral, which was a very high compliment.
That is, yeah.
And I had a funeral that day already scheduled. People are just dying to get my attention. Anyway. But anyway, I couldn't do it, and I felt bad. And I haven't heard from David, and he's been out a lot again since the Iron Claw came out. He's a great guy and a very creative mind.
Unbelievable.
Very important part of the promotion. Was the booker for a while.
Yes.
In the later years.
Right. And I think that was one of the many reasons why we wanted you on the show, why we had David on the show, is to preserve that legacy, that it wasn't just one family or one man or two brothers or three brothers. It was an entire organization that made this company work, work so well for such a long period of time. And having you just come on and reminisce a few stories was a pure honor. So thank you so much for being on our show.
Honor for me to be here. Appreciate your friendship, and we'll do it when you want to.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks again for listening to Territory Marks. If you like what you hear, then consider giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. While you're at it, head on over to our Patreon too. The link is in our show notes.
And if you want more 80s nostalgia, go check out my tag partner Zach and our Terry Bam Bam of Ballyhoo, Dustin, over at $2LateFee.com, where the faces always win, even in the territories.
Oh, listen, I just wanted to say goodbye and remind you that the good guys always win, even in the 80s.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.